Hi everyone, my name is Philip Ayazika.
And my name is Charity Mukasha.
Welcome to the second episode of the Human Rights and the Digital podcast, where we present voices and perspectives of human rights defenders in Uganda, and we focus on how technology is being used to the realization of human rights. Catch other episodes and learn more about what we do, please visit www.digitalhumanrightslab.org. Charity, what is our topic today and what should the listeners expect?
Thank you, Philip. So today our topic is defending human rights in a digital age. In this episode, we explore how human rights defenders in Uganda are embracing ICTs to adapt to new working conditions in these times of a global pandemic. With everything going digital because of the quarantine requirements, we dig deep to understand how the legal fraternity in Uganda is embracing ICTs to ensure continued access to justice, even in these tough times of the coronavirus disease. We're joined today by Mr. Brian Geoffrey Chanwat, our partner and a beneficiary of the Digital Human Rights Lab project. He is also the team lead of Strategic Response International, also known as SRI.
Great. You're very welcome to today's episode, Brian. Let's dive right into it. Brian, tell us about yourself and your work at SRI.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me. I am glad to be here. About myself, my name is Brian Geoffrey Chanwat. I am a lawyer by training and passionate about human rights. I do also part of pro-democracy work, where we help activists who are in true political activities in terms of arrests. So in my line of work, I've been at the forefront of tracking and documenting rights violations across Uganda. My major aim as well is to empower vulnerable people to claim their rights and freedoms through building their capacities. This is particularly through training that I've been doing to human rights defenders across the country. I am also the co-founder and team lead at Strategic Response International. SRI is a network of young pro-democracy, human rights, and social justice-oriented lawyers across Uganda. We unite young human rights lawyers to provide a robust legal response on matters that undermine any of the principles of democracy and human rights. Of course, this is through litigation and counsel across the country. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Brian. I just have a quick question for you in response to what you've just shared. So on the 18th of March, the president of Uganda, he put in place a lockdown suspending a lot of activities as a precautionary measure to slow down the spread of the coronavirus disease. How has this pandemic and the lockdown in specific impacted human rights work in Uganda?
Well, thanks for asking, Charity. We must know that it is really sad that we have been cornered. By cornered, I mean we've all been locked up in whatever we are doing, and we have a lot of limitations. And these limitations have come with great challenges in all our work, whether you're in the human rights field, the legal, I mean the medical, and all other general fields. Of course, on a good note, I must say that the lockdown is kind of saving so many. We've seen so many countries losing numbers of people because of the laxity in certain systems that they're carrying on. So particularly for us, the lockdown has been both good and bad. One, we have been safe as lawyers who are more of grassroots agents for human rights defenders. We all know that the coronavirus disease is spread through contact and so on and so forth. So the lockdown in itself has been good, that most of us have been safe. But then on the bad side of it is that it has let so many human rights issues arise. For example, people are not getting access to legal representation because of these lockdowns. people are not getting adequate legal advice for those who cannot afford maybe a digital tool to access a lawyer. So it has been kind of sad to note that all this is happening, and we've seen human rights issues arising. So we have also tried to adjust to go with the digital age, where we are now providing legal support over the internet using our various frameworks, including phone calls, WhatsApp messages, direct messages, and all other media that someone can use to reach us, so they can have access to at least basic legal advice on how they should go about their day-to-day activities. Yeah, so that is how the lockdown has greatly affected us.
Thank you, Brian. That was a very insightful take. And now, Philip, over to you. So in your perspective, Philip, as our engagement lead here, how has the lockdown and the pandemic at large impacted human rights work?
I think I just want to agree with Brian. I think the pandemic itself has had both a positive and negative impact on human rights work. And I want to speak specifically to the concept of Uganda, because during the coronavirus pandemic, we've seen a big shift, a very massive shift of human rights work going online. So we've seen both the government and the private sector embrace all these ICTs and the digital tools to make sure that there's still access to justice. And especially for the private sector, I want to applaud you, Brian, and the whole, you know, all the human rights defenders in Uganda that have made sure that even during these tough times, work continues. So on a positive note, I think coronavirus has really brought out the idea of how it is important to, you know, integrate ICTs or digital technologies into human rights work itself. Because without that, then, I mean, in situations like this, then we wouldn't have human rights work continue. On the other side of the coin, though, we've seen a very big, you know, backslide into human rights work. So to begin with, what has happened, like you mentioned, Charity, like when the president of Uganda put in place a lockdown, similarly in other countries when all these lockdowns were put in place and other measures, we saw a curtailing on a limitation to human rights defenders' work. So most of, for the case of Uganda, human rights defenders were not listed as necessary services, if for lack of a better word. So they were not among the few sectors that were allowed to, you know, proceed with work and, you know, go to their offices. So we had a big number of human rights defenders not able to access, you know, their clients, and also not able to access their work premises, which on my end, I think, was a very big backslide. Whereas it was necessary, it brought around big issues around human rights defense, you know, defending human rights work. But also, considering that, whereas the statistics around the internet penetration in Uganda say different numbers, but I want to use a statistic of the 42% of internet penetration. So we realize that the internet penetration in Uganda is 42%. Even when some of the work that we can see shifted online, human rights work shifted online and providing support, we can only imagine how many people are excluded. We have lots of community champions that are protecting and fighting and doing human rights work in the grassroots communities. So such people that do not have access to, you know, internet in their communities, I think they were totally left out. But also not to mention even other human rights defenders that maybe had access to internet, but then did not have the right digital skills to use all these tools that were available to do human rights work. So wholesomely, I think the pandemic itself has opened eyes, our eyes, or human rights defenders' eyes, to look into the need of integrating digital technologies into the kind of work that they do, which is also something I want, I always mention that this is exactly what the Digital Human Rights Lab is doing, to, you know, foster a digital mindset among human rights defenders. You know, as things develop, we need to look for better means on how best we can advocate for human rights. So if human rights violations are shifting online, then it definitely means that human rights defenders also need to think of how best do they use these online tools to these digital technologies to proceed their work. So yeah, that is most of it from my end. But also still on that note on how the legal fraternity in Uganda did embrace digital tools, I want to ask you, Brian, in your blog that we publish on the Digital Human Rights Lab website, that is the www.digitalhumanrightslab.org, you mentioned how the government and the private sector in Uganda had formally adopted the use of ICTs to enhance access to justice. Brent, tell us, how does this exactly look like on the ground?
Well, thanks for asking, Philip. Before I respond to that, allow me to supplement that on the part of lawyers, I think most of them are embracing this kind of transformation, that you don't have to be physically in a place to make sure that something gets done. We have seen many people, many lawyers, for example, Onyango and company advocates, trying to digitalize their offices. For example, the services you can get at the offices, at the premises physically, can now be accessed through the internet. So you just have to punch in a few things on the internet, and then someone on the back end at office will be able to process your request and you still get the service you need. Also, even when it comes to payment, there's always that mobile money prompt. So everything has gone virtual. So that is the good news that lawyers are embracing. Now, these are lawyers in private practice. Back to your question. Yes, the blog post was written to sort of intrigue the understanding of many people, particularly lawyers, that even before the coronavirus, there had already been some initiatives to showcase that ICT is the way to go. Because I wouldn't be wrong if I said that the new world order is ICT now. The internet is literally everything, from the word go, that you go to your Google and search something, you find all the answers you need. So it's really the way to go. So in regard to that blog post, yes, we have appreciated so many interventions that have come in. We have seen developments, for example, in service delivery. By service delivery, I'm going to pay attention to the legal service delivery and generally in communication, that most of these things don't require anything physical. Now, yes, the government has taken it up also to a larger scale, I must say. We have seen laws being enacted to facilitate the smooth running of the ICT infrastructure, for example, in access to justice. So under the Constitution, particularly Article 133.1b, these are powers of the Chief Justice to service delivery or access to justice is still achieved. So we saw a couple of rules coming into play. These rules particularly introduce the element of ICT in the administration of justice in the courts of law. For example, we saw the constitution integration of ICT and adjudication process for courts of judicature. These are practice directions. These are purely to guide on what delivery justice using the ICT framework should look like. We also saw the judicature visual audio links of 2016. I think you're all familiar with this one. You saw people, for example, should I call them suspects, being tried from Luzira Maximum Prison or you know, by remotely. They don't necessarily have to come to court. So they're tried, their sessions go on, whereas the lawyer will be here in court, but the suspect will be in the prison. At least we've seen so many activists being tried on that. So this is how far the government has gone in terms of laying the foundation, laying the procedure, and laying how all these things can be done. Now, in the administration of justice still, access to information, particularly legal information, has also been key. Now, if you know, there's a website, we lawyers abbreviate it as ULI. ULI is ULII. So it stands for Uganda Legal Information Institute, I think. And this is purely to give you an up to, you know, an up-to-date sort of rulings that have been passed by courts. So we have judgments that are passed. We have, I think most of them have been taken back. Most of them are now, they were transcribed and entered into the system, that you can access judgment from any court in Uganda just by sitting in front of your laptop or your phone and then just searching for the case you want, or even looking at the year in which it was, you know, decided. So these are all the advancements sort of accepting ICT in the administration of justice. Now, the other unique one is one that is internally used by the judiciary. It has something to do with the administration of the court cases. Now, it's called the court case administration system. Now, this one here is purely to register, maintain, retrieve, and disseminate cause list. A cause list is what is to be, you know, to be decided on or to be, you know, had in the setting of court. For example, we can have a cause list for July. So the cause list of July is already out for week one, should be out. So we get to know all these informations here. So if you go to court, for example, let me give an example of a random court like Nakawa Court. You'll go and then you'll see there's a TV screen there, which will display, you know, the case, the time, which courtroom, which justice is going to decide. So now that is the advancement in all that. That people no longer have to call a clerk. Hey, when is my ruling? When is my case going to be decided? When is the hearing? So all these things here have been advanced in terms of incorporating the ICT element. Of course, all these can be accessed over the internet. That is how far the government has gone. And recently, we held a webinar on COVID-19 and the role of lawyers. In that webinar, we assessed what lawyers need to do. For example, who are interesting lawyers to use ICT in, you know, their daily work. And we had the spokesperson of the judiciary, Mr. Solomon Muita, who acknowledged that the government is actually playing a key part in terms of advancing the ICT infrastructure, at least in most of the major court circuits. I hope this is done within the stipulated time. So there is progress that the judiciary is actually advancing in terms of providing this kind of infrastructure. So that is how thick the element of ICT is in terms of the legal sector, the justice sector that we are trying to appreciate and getting to learn that it's actually important in our work. So when it comes to the NGO world and the civil society, we have seen tremendous innovations that have come up to extend the services of a particular organization to its people and so on. So I will start with, for example, Strategic Response International. Starting, I think, on Monday, we are rolling out some sort of project where we are going to be tracking and documenting all these rights violations arising from the COVID-19. These allegations here start from around March, when the lockdowns were instituted, where we saw a lot of brutality on the end of security forces and so on and so forth. So this project is meant to track and document all these violations here, and then later advocate for justice to be dispensed on these issues here. So it's a purely ICT sort of related project where we don't even need to be there in the physical at a place, but we can easily access this information, which can be transmitted to us through our contact, our focal persons. So this is going to, we are going to build a system which will look more of a live tracker. For example, if something happened in Cotido, someone will be able to click Cotido on the map, and then it should be able to display all the issues that have arisen, all the human rights issues that arose from the COVID-19 enforcement of curfew and so on and so forth. So that is how far ICT is actually helping some of us in doing this kind of work. So it's a blessing in disguise. Had it not come, we'd still be struggling to maybe board a bus to go there, meet a client, meet the victim, and so on. So it is. It has enhanced our ability to work remotely. Yeah. So on the other general. Civil society, we've seen so many innovations. For example, barefoot law. Barefoot law has since the time they started, been at the forefront of providing access to legal information over social media. We have seen so many questions, so many concerns, so many stuff done over the internet. For example, on Facebook. I think I am a beneficiary of barefoot law. When I was at law school, it was already running, and some of my work, my coursework, my questions, my concerns were addressed by them, where I put something to them over Facebook, and then I got an answer. So that is how the ICT infrastructure is being utilized in the administration of justice.
You've highlighted all the amazing and phenomenal ways that, government is incorporating ICT strategies. We're learning about organizations that have even been doing work, in the way that you have described, like Barefoot Law offering, what they were offering via social media. I don't know if you could now specifically share some of the digital tools, both from the government side and the private sector side, that are currently in play, and how exactly are those tools supporting access to justice during this time?
Generally, these, for example, on the part of government, we have seen several, I don't want to call them innovations, but particular sort of sites that have been helpful in terms of accessing information, particularly legal information. We've seen, like I mentioned in my previous question, the Uganda Legal Information Institute, which generally reports on all cases that have been heard. We have the court administration system, which provides it gives all judicial officers a one-on center where they can probably access all these cases digitally, so they don't have to be in a particular space, but rather log in with their credentials and then have access to all these cases. So that is on the government side. But then on the private sector side, particularly CSOs and NGOs, Most of them have been through innovations like applications that have come in. We've seen Pulidawo by Uganda Law Society. We've seen Justice Boat. Now, Justice Boat is a very unique innovation that uses artificial intelligence just over your messenger. You simply ask a question and then it is responded to right away. I don't know how far they've gone with their innovation, but it's also a very helpful tool in accessing justice. So the NGO sector is rather transforming work, I mean, transforming themselves to be able to remotely provide services to their clientele through, I don't want to call it, innovation again, but sort of technology that helps them to actually get more from the client than actually the client is getting from them. So it's a good initiative. And I think the technological element, which I am not so good at, not my area at all, is the way to go. Most of these NGOs are using these digital tools, applications, surveys, questionnaires, and all that to get feedback from the community, so they can actually design programs that assist those communities.
How both, of course, the government and the private sector are working together to sort of see how they reconcile all these open innovations, if they are open. Of course, they are open because, I mean, they're trying to serve a common cause here. Because I hope it doesn't happen just like we saw in the health sector, where we had a moratorium of all these health e-health applications and interventions, and seeing a duplication of some of the interventions. So it will be interesting to see how best are you reconciling all these innovations to make sure that they are effective and there's no duplication. So moving on, Brian, I'm sure there have been shortcomings and challenges with the adoption of some of these digital tools that you've talked about and interventions. And as a partner with the Digital Human Rights Lab, how do you say the lab has supported overcoming some of these challenges that might have come out of embracing these digital tools, especially for the private sector and human rights defenders in the private sector?
Thanks, Philip. The unique thing about the Digital Human Rights Lab is the way they work. One is the formation of COPs. Like I noted earlier, most of these organizations here they innovate to suit their kind of work. So not that they do everything, but in that particular thing that they do, their innovation is always around there. Now, the Digital Human Rights Lab, through its formation of COPs, puts together a number of organizations who sit down and brainstorm and discuss what they bring to the table, which is a more, I should call it, it's rather a smarter way of doing things, that you bring so many ideas from different elements, from different organizations, and then put them into one and probably solve a bigger problem. Because issues of human rights, for example, have the element of legal, have the element of psychological, have the element of health, have the element, so many things that only, if, for example, SRI can only do legal, and then maybe someone will do psychosocial, maybe someone else will do health. So if all these organizations are brought into one, then someone can easily access, it's more of a basket that a human rights defender can access all these things. So one, the Digital Human Rights Lab has been able to give a platform for many organizations to bring to the table what they do best, and then put all these ideas together, merge them, and they're probably doing a much bigger cause. The challenges that have been there is one, on the government side, of course, the infringing issues like the OTT tax, which limits so many people from accessing services. the high internet costs, because now ICT generally is internet based. So of course those are the general costs, but the idea is there, the will is there. These limitations here, irrespective of whether they are there or not, these innovations are coming up, and the Digital Human Rights Lab is playing a key part in building them from scratch to reach where they should be in terms of provision of the services. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Brian. Very interesting. And Brian has referred to a webinar and a blog. For our listeners, we shall definitely attach a link to both the webinar and the blog in the About section of this episode. Moving on, Charity, the massive shift online that, of course, came with the coronavirus pandemic came with lots of challenges, some of which were already existing, but others sort of came in the due process. One of those that stood out for me especially was the spike in human rights violations online, which did manifest and still manifests in various ways. Of course, from talk about cyberbullying, online gender-based violence. From your experience, Charity, as a communications expert, how best can we tackle this, the human rights violations online?
Thank you, Philip. And thank you, Brian, as well. You have really opened my mind up to the different ways in which sectors, you know, like the justice sector can quickly evolve to be able to, you know, to work for the people and to serve the people. So in a very similar way, I believe that inclusion during our problem-solving processes can take us really far into thinking about the people that we're serving. And in this instance, it would be the people, the Ugandans that are online. So how, for example, when, you know, recently government is coming up with all these bills and laws and things are getting passed and we don't know why or how, and we just see them, for example, recently passing a new law regarding borders accessing the CBD. But then border riders were going into town the next day. And, you know, government was saying, we posted this information and shared it online and across various WhatsApp channels. But then the border riders are saying, how are we supposed to know of something that was decided upon and shared digital? We don't have access to these social media platforms to be able to get this information. So I think the same applies to even cyberbullying or GBV. People can no longer, I believe in the courts of law, you cannot go and plead the fifth. You can't say, I didn't know that it was illegal for me to, you know, to do something. So we definitely need to create more inclusive processes on how we raise awareness and let people know what their rights are. So what can be punishable by law? What can I report if somebody calls me something offensive on Twitter, or if somebody leaks my nude, or, you know, things like that, which a lot of people have been doing. I think a lot of the users online need to know that the law actually protects you from that kind of bullying. The law actually can protect you from, you know, from all of these issues. And these are the places, for example, that you should go to if you are a victim of cyberbullying. And, you know, these are the lawyers, the individuals that can help you fight back if you find that you are a victim of cyberbullying and GBV. So in terms of communication specifically, I think that everybody, you know, the government, players within the human rights sector, law firms that are currently digitizing their processes, I think they really need to think about how they are tailoring their communication strategies in a way that everybody, even people who might not necessarily be able to pay for internet or OTT, in a way that everybody can know that this is my right, you know. So an easy way is to say, okay, as we're all turning online, people are still listening to radio. So to go to a radio station and, for example, start having an awareness drive on radio that is is letting listeners know that eventually when you do come online, these are some of the things that you should look out for. Recently, I was talking to a teenager about video gaming, and and he was taking me through some of the things that he feels anyone that is gaming online needs to keep in mind. For example, not using your personal identifying information. The president recently said we have to give our phone numbers and national IDs to any border rider if we're using them. So is it legal for me to share that information? How am I protected? And how is my personal data being protected? So yeah, in a nutshell, I'd say inclusive communication strategies, both by the government and legal entities, can go a long way into mitigating a lot of the online cyberbullying or online GBV that's going on.
Thank you so much, Charity. You mentioned something earlier on as you're starting your point that about inclusivity, of course, and that reminded me of someone who said that a city cannot develop more than its inhabitants. So, I mean, as you make all these laws and, you know, all these new things, you bring in all these new things, they need to, you know, be more inclusive and get people's opinion and make sure all of you are on the same boat. But also, you mentioned something on awareness about some of these issues. You know, I think it starts with awareness, making sure that people know what does the law say or what are their rights, and that people know that they have a right to access a safe internet. And I know still on about human rights violations online, we have, in Uganda, we have laws like the Computer Misuse Act. And that is where I want to ask Brian, what does the law say about such online abuses? And how best can we all, and when I say all, I mean the general public, the internet users, the Ugandans online, or even people out of Uganda, how can we be part of the solution? How best can we all advocate for a safer internet? Brian?
Thanks for asking, Philip. Well, like Charity noted, these laws are purely to protect us. There is no law that I've had which, except those ones that are repressive to favor, certain issues in government. All these laws here that are put in place and are meant for the general public are purely to protect us. Cyber crimes generally span from human rights issues to elements of criminal law. So we need to be distinct. Whereas something may infringe on your human right, it could also take the criminal approach in terms of on how whether the allegation or the accusation falls maybe under our mother penal law, which is the penal code. So, for example, you mentioned the Computer Misuse Act, Philip. The Computer Misuse Act purely concentrates on offenses committed over electronic media. By electronic media, we mean the computers, the phones, and all that. And you know what comes with those, with electronic media, includes social media, e.g. WhatsApp, Facebook, Twitter, and all that. And that is where most of the online violations occur. Issues of your privacy, stalking, and all that come into play. Now, there are also elements on cyber crimes that actually go take the other side of the coin, which extend to fraud and then, you know, password harvesting, defamation, offensive communications. Now, all these are offenses in Uganda, and there's a penalty for breach of each in the event that someone breaches any of those sections of the Computer Misuse Act. Now, the Data Protection Act, which I think was passed in 2019, protects individuals, particularly data, your data, your credentials, it's a regulation that purely guides on how it is obtained and how it is processed and also protects the rights of those, you know, when your data is taken from you. So that particular law is purely to protect you and your data around there. So for safety, online safety is key. We just have to be vigilant that you keep your eye on the lookout. There are these, you know, prompts that come in, your password to join this, and then there are these free Wi-Fi spots, you know, those are the kind of small things that make you insecure online, where your data is collected and probably used against you. And it is now individual that it is me, my phone and my laptop. So whatever I do over the phone, over the laptop, I should purely have control over it. So we have to be vigilant while in online spaces and keep our stuff, passwords and photos and galleries, all of that, we keep all that safe. So that is, in my perspective, that is how safe we can be if we are to continue using our media, if we are to keep online.
I just listening to, you know, to this conversation, I just keep thinking how critical it is for us to figure out how we can share as much of this golden information with the public, you know, with everybody. I think maybe to just supplement on what has been shared, what I also like about how we can advocate for a safer, I would say a safer community, even outside of the internet, is that we can now use the internet as a tool for advocacy as well. We've seen cases where there's people who do not have access to a smartphone or, you know, a device that has internet connection, but they are definitely having their, you know, their rights as humans violated. You know, there's been a spike in domestic violence. There's been a spike in defilement and rape during this lockdown. And a lot of those people don't even know where to begin to get justice because, you know, there's been lockdown. You can't move to the police station. But what I have loved is that people like you and I, you know, the three of us who have access to a Twitter account online, can advocate for justice for somebody else who we see is going through something, you know, really terrible. So I have also been really mesmerized by some of those interventions where, you know, somebody's child was maybe defiled and they didn't get justice from police, but then they made a lot of noise online. And despite their poverty, despite their background, despite their social status, they were able to get the attention that was required in order to get justice. So in a similar way that we can also think about how our privilege and our rights that we get to enjoy on the internet, we get to think about how can we also extend that same privilege to the people around us, to the people in our communities who might not necessarily have the access to internet and to all these platforms that we get to enjoy. And so, Brian, this is maybe a question for you. With everything that you've shared that is so exciting, you know, all the information we felt that we couldn't even fit into this one podcast. If any of our listeners would like to reach out to you and get in touch with you or with SRI, how do they do that? How do they go about reaching out to you, Brian?
Thanks, Charity. I am personally a digital human being, so I am always available online. As an organization, our role is to make sure that we are always available, that whoever needs legal representation or generally legal advice can easily access it through us. So we do our level best to ensure that we are on. So we can be reached physically at plot 14 Mwafu Road in Ministers Village in Tinda. So that plot particularly is not far from UNEB. So in case you may be coming to visit us physically, get to UNEB and then you give us a call. Our telephone number is 0778-654-929. Now, for those who would like to reach us via email, our organization email address is info, which is INFO at sri-uganda.org. That is the general organization website, email address. And then for myself as Brian, the team lead, you can reach me on BCHANWAT, which stands for B Chanwat at sri-uganda.org. Our website is www.sri-uganda.org. In regard to reporting rights violation, we have an email address that will be available effective Monday. The email address for reporting rights violations will be report@sri-uganda.org. So that is what we are going to be using to receive rights violations, accused allegations that come into us for probably action. So that is how best we can be reached.
Thank you, Brian. That's all from us today. Thank you for joining us. Stay tuned and look out for our next episodes as we present to you voices and perspectives of human rights defenders from Uganda.
And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. If you have feedback or you need to learn more about the Digital Human Rights Lab, please visit www.digitalhumanrightslab.org. That's www.digitalhumanrightslab.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at DHR Lab or on Facebook at the Digital Human Rights Lab. Until next time, from all of us to you, bye.